Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is J.J. Blair, who discusses the new album from Mike Finnegan. Blair wanted his longtime friend Finnegan to make a new record late in the last decade, but Finnegan was initially reluctant. Over time, a new collection of songs began to emerge, culminating in the new album, Mike Finnegan, which may stand as the veteran musician's finest. Finnegan died in 2021, with some of the album still uncompleted. Blair remained committed to releasing the collection, ultimately issuing the record via 40 Below Records. The LP features guest appearances from Kelly Finnegan, Smokey Robinson, Chris and Stephen Stills, Joe Bonamassa, and Dean Parks. In this conversation, Blair discusses the genesis of the album, Finnegan's approach to recording the Merle Haggard classic Sing Me Back Home, and what Blair remembers and misses most about his friend. That's J.J. Blair talking about Mike Finnegan on Into Music, coming up now. I just have to say, overall, I was always a little sad that there weren't more Mike Finnegan records out there. But I feel like this is the one that he was trying to make the whole time.
You know, it's funny. I'm looking at Spotify numbers and I see there's this one track from 78 that keeps popping up and has all these listens. And I'm like, I've never heard of this. What is this? And it's basically a yacht rock song. And I'm like, boy, you know, and it's part of the reason I had never heard this one, but it's part of the reason why I really, really wanted to make this record. Is I just felt like, you know, whoever A&R'd his other records, I mean, solo records, because I think the, you know, that like Finnegan and Wood and stuff, there's some stuff that, you know, it's right there. But I was like, man, I don't know, they were trying too much to do whatever the fashionable thing was at the time. But I was like, let's do music he really just has in his soul.
When did this project kind of start to take shape?
I had been chasing him for years and years to do something. And then sometime in 2018, this is how long it took, Bill Lynch had put a little outfit together at his club that isn't around anymore called the Write-Off Room. So it was Bill Lynch, Mike, James Gadson on drums, and Abe Laboriel Sr. on bass, you know, quite a band. You know, it was Bill's band, but whenever Mike would sing a tune, it would just bring the house down. And I think one of the things that was bugging him that he was reticent about was he felt that he had had a little bit of vocal cord damage, and he felt he couldn't hit his high notes like he should. And he still sings circles around everybody, but you know, he felt like a little bit of diminishment there. So, I said, dude, you're like this, you're so good right now. I don't know what you're talking about. Let's just go, let me book a day at East West. Let's go in, you pick a song, I'll pick a song. We'll figure out who the musicians are. If you hate it, we'll forget it ever happened. And if you love it, let me see if I can, you know, find someone to give us a budget and make a record. And the song that he'd performed that night that brought the house down was Don't Answer the Door. And that was the first thing we recorded. And we had, you know, like the first take, it was just like, holy moly, you know. And we never beat that first take. But it was like, we knew we had something. We had my friend David Goodstein on drums, and we had Bob Glob on bass, who's, you know, a legend and a dear old friend of Mike's, and Josh Sklar, who was Etta James MD for so many years and also played with Mike, you know, for so many years on guitar. you have a good song and amazing musicians who, you know, who understand it and or how to do that music, and then my job is simply to not screw up and make sure I capture it. Because Mike was really in charge of, I'm the producer, but Mike was doing the arrangements. He and I picked the songs together, but that was, the arrangements were always like Mike Finnegan for sure. That's how it started. And then there was just a whole, I played him, Joe Bonamassa is a close friend. I said, hey, let me know who you think I should bring these to, in the blues label universe. And then he said, I think maybe I'd like to put it out on my label. And while that was kind of going on, I was just like, let's just go, let's just keep recording stuff. And we managed to record 10 songs and I got 7 vocals before pandemic hit. And then, and Mike became sick. And then when Mike passed, the type of deal that Joe's label does holds the masters in perpetuity, and the family wasn't going to be okay. Mike was fine with it, but the family wasn't going to be okay with it because that was, his last record. So I had to scramble, and that took a while to find somebody, not only, and also to get, figure out how am I going to finish the songs that Mike didn't sing on. So I had one song where I was able to put together a lot of vocal from his scratches, but it was going to be a duet with his son Kelly, who I don't know if you know what a phenomenal singer he is, and producer and everything. So that was Let That Liar Alone. So that turned out as Mike wanted it, and those are Mike's scratch takes. Like, that's how amazing Mike was. What You Do, The Things You Do was going to be a duet with Smokey, but I didn't have anything other than, Mike sing, doing the tagline when we were tracking it. Smokey's new album was coming out, so he was nervous about doing the whole thing, because that his label might get upset. So Smokey sang a verse, Gadson sang a verse, and my friend Dorian Holly, who is like one of the top session singers in LA, sang a verse and did all the harmonies. So we got that one figured out. Then the last one was All That You Dream, which I had always was hoping, there was a little bit of acrimony between Mike and Bonnie Raitt after Mike was let go from the band. And I was kind of hoping that they would repair the relationship and I could get that to be a duet with Bonnie because of her relationship with Lowell George, being basically his protege. And just the feeling I got was, I think I could have gotten Bonnie to do it, but the family was grieving and there was so much sensitivity. I didn't want to push that envelope. And I just I don't know. So I got Stephen Stills and his son, Chris Stills, to do it, which was great because, some of that, Stephen's the man, but he's a little older now, and you need some of that soaring stuff in the chorus. And Chris is such a phenomenal singer that it's amazing. We haven't even pushed that as a single, and the numbers on that one on Spotify have been really great. I don't know if it's the Stephen connection or people just love Little Feet, but that track came out so beautifully. And that is Mike's arrangement as well. Yeah. Oh, and then we had to find a label. and find a label that wanted to take on an artist who isn't here to promote it. And I was so lucky to wind up with 40 Below, who not only this is one of their genres that they excel at, but they understood what a great record it was. And they understood that, between my own social media following and some of the people who are involved with the project who were happy to help, give us a quote or promote it. Particularly Bonamassa was so incredibly helpful for us getting noticed. So it really, it worked out.
Well, I think Eric did the last couple of John Mayall records, right?
He did.
And I think that those records had more visibility than some of the things that Mayall had been doing.
Yes.
And that was a real, I think, feather in his cap.
Yeah, Eric is a really smart guy in general, but he kind of understands how to work indie records in this day and age, which is very different than even 15, 10, 15 years ago. It's, the role of social media, and because you can't, you can't just hire a promoter and send a program director a bag of blow and some pretty ladies. That's not, those days are over. There's a whole new way to, get attention to everything, and terrestrial radio, it is not the end all be all it used to be for promotion.
Well, I want to come back to All That You Dream, because it is such a phenomenal song. But maybe one, I think I just kind of realized maybe an unintentional thing there is that you've got Steven and Chris, who's just amazing, on a record with Mike and Kelly. So there's this kind of generational thing that happened as well.
Which occurred to me, yes. And Kelly is Steven's godson, by the way.
Oh, wow. That's heavy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I just think that that's just such a really beautiful track on the record and just so well done.
Thank you. And and that's a credit to the players. And it's funny, I don't even know if he knows this, and hopefully he doesn't watch this interview. We had tracked that with David Goodstein on drums, and it was great, but there was something. David's such a phenomenal drummer, but I'm like, this needs to be dumber, like this just needs to be, like, and he's so great at, doing simple drumming and everything, but I'm like, this needs to be even dumber. And so I asked Gadsden, I'm like, can you redo these drums? Because there is just something about the way that Gadsden can do just a straight four on the floor, and it has a, it's so subtle, but it's what makes that man magical. And to prove the point, on the way you do the things you do, it wasn't until I started, when I started working on the tracks after we'd recorded, and I solo the drums, and I realized the shuffle that he's playing, because Mike had arranged it. Mike, first off, Mike was like reticent to do that song. He's like, everybody's done it. And I was doing a record with Smokey at the time, and I just want to, make things easy for a label to promote it and whatnot. And Smokey had recently told me the story of how he wrote the song. So I said, hey, Mike, what if I can get Smokey to do this with us? Would he do it? And he goes, yeah, everyone's done it. I'm like, but who's done it with the guy who wrote it? And then I said, Smokey, would you do a song for this record? He goes, well, it depends on the song. I go, what if it's one you wrote? He's like, oh, okay. So that was the things. But Mike, because it's been done 8 million times, Mike wanted to do it differently. And the feel he came up with was sort of that early James Brown broken wagon wheel, that good dunk, good dunk, good dunk. Good dunk. And when I soloed Gadsden's drums, he's playing in a style, it's like the idea when you play drums is to split your hands. You want everything to be independent. But his feet and both hands are all going at the same time. Chunk, 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 chunk. So he's playing the kick drum, the snare, and the hi-hat, all in that thing, which is what Willie Big Eye Smith used to do with Muddy Waters. Like, that's a very specific thing. And technically, anybody can do that because you don't have to have coordination to play different rhythms at the same time. But to do it with the proper feel and swing is something very, very few people can do. So Gadsden intuited to do it that way, and it makes the track just so, like I said, it's got that early James Brown feel. It's so funky. And so to bring him in on All That You Dream and just go, just give me four on the floor. And even though he's technically playing something very simple, there is that man is just a magician at putting a groove. And I think most people would have been fine with David's version, but I really wanted, like, I wanted to go the extra mile and make this like really, extra, extra special. And Val McKellum's guitar playing on it, and you know, really helps that. And Mike's Hammond playing, and his any time that I could, I would pull out the clavinet and get Mike to play on it, because he was so funky. And I was just like, so I think we have some clav on that and some stuff. That was a special track.
I got to tell you, like, before I even listened to it, I saw Sing Me Back Home as the last track, and I immediately just got emotional. Was that always going to be kind of like the send-off for the record?
I think when we tracked it, it was obvious that that's the last track. And then especially after Mike passed, it was very obvious. And a couple people thought that should be the title of the album. And I said that would be appropriate. However, I don't want people to think that this is a country record or even a sentimental record, because I think that would kind of connotate that. But it's funny. I in the 80s, I used to follow the Dead around the country, and Mike didn't think very highly of them. That's not, you know, Mike was very funny. He was such a snob. He just thought Led Zeppelin was a load of crap. And it had to be like really great blues or country based stuff, or he just thought it was awful. And I understood that. But the Dead used to do, in the early 70s, they did a version of Sing Me Back Home that was just slow and dirgy. And I always thought, like, oh yeah, that's what the song's about. This, you know, I understand why Merle cut it in sort of that peppy Bakersfield vibe, but it doesn't really quite capture the emotion of the story as well as that. When I heard that slow version the Dead did, that was just so gut-wrenching, even with their crappy singing and everything, it was like oh yeah. And so I you know, Mike kind of turned his nose up at me mentioning the Dead, but, you know, he thought about it because it is a Merle song. And then I sent him a little sketch of a verse and chorus doing it in a slow tempo. And then he came back, because he's always thinking Ray Charles. And I think he was thinking what Ray would have done on New Directions. And he turned it into that waltz. You know, that bluesy gospely waltz. And it was just like, absolutely. I just put out the video of it today, because it was the only one of two songs that we had that we videoed in the studio, because we didn't know we weren't going to be able to make videos of this after the fact. And there's a band in LA called Jack Shit, who is Pete Thomas and Davey Farragher, who are Elvis Costello's rhythm section in The Impostors, and Val McCallum, whom I've already spoken of, who's currently with Jackson Browne and has played on so many records and is one of my favorite guitar players. But they do a lot of Flying Burrito Brothers and stuff like that, and they really understand how to do country cool. But they harmonize so beautifully. So when I sold the idea of doing the song to Mike, I said, can we do it with these guys? Because I want to get a live vocal. There's certain songs I really, really wanted to get Mike playing and singing at the same time, because it just, the way that he did that was incredible. It was just a different side of his personality than singing by himself. And his whole body took over, and the way he would manipulate all the controls of the Hammond and the way he would sing and interact. And it was just one thing. And I was like, I got to capture that. And then these guys sing so beautifully. I said, this is going to be a live vocal, you know, so you're going to sing during the tracking. I think having the harmony there really affected the way that Mike approached it too. And that's, you know, I'm gonna say this now. I'm gonna push. I noticed that there is a Best Americana Performance category. I don't know why there's not a Best Blues Performance category, which seems dumb, but there is a Best Americana Performance category, and I'm gonna push like hell for that one, because I feel that really fits the Americana vibe, and it is like, that is a performance for the ages. I teamed him up with amazing musicians, and he inspired them to be at the top of their game. And I just sort of fed him the idea, and then once again, it was Mike's arrangement, and he just always made everybody better on every session, because they're like, this dude's bad. I better bring it.
Of course, he passed in the, before the record was really complete. How do you kind of approach the family, saying, look, we've got this, and
I don't want to get too much into it, because it's tricky, because there's family dynamics involved. I owned the masters. Mike and I had an agreement. Whether or not I could do it was not the question. Whether or not I could do it in a way that was going to make them okay, which has been tricky and not always successful, which is all I'll say. But because grieving's hard, and having the type of void left in your life that a man like Mike Finnegan would fill, is very hard. It took me a long time. Like, it took a long time to get Kelly in, because that's not something you can just go in and sing on, right away. And he was so great. And whether or not everybody agrees with me that I did it as respectfully as I could, I that was what I tried to do. I did my best. So, and the record's out, and that's the important thing. And in the end, I always feel the same way. When you put something out, it's no longer yours. So we got it out there. It's not mine, it's not Mike's, it's not the family's, it's the listeners now at this point. And so I've just, I've gotten it out there. And once you put something out, it's just the proprietary idea goes out the window. It's the listener and how they're reacting and interpreting it.
I just want to talk very, very quickly about Mike as a person. The stories of him being so a generous and caring person are pretty legion. I know that he was kind to younger musicians. I know that he cared very deeply about people in recovery, that apparently he was very funny.
And that's one of my regrets of about him not being here for the promotion of this record, is to just see what an eloquent, well-read, hysterical person he was. I mean, we had so many laughs. We had a very similar sense of humor, and we're both, very quick, and we would just keep each other in stitches. And I regret that, people don't get to see that, because it was just, he had just such a magnetic personality. I mean, I met him when I was 20, and we wound up in each other's lives because of recovery. But I didn't, it's funny, I like to tell a story. I didn't know who he was. He wore like Eddie Bauer khaki stuff, and like a button down shirt, and I go, and I'm like, is this guy a dentist? Who is this dude? And then someone was like, no, that's the dude who played on Rainy Day Dream Away. And I'm like, that's a white guy? That's a white guy on that tune? There's no way. Like, yeah, that's that dude. But I was drawn to Mike because, my father died when I was 9. I never really, my stepdad and I, we didn't get along, and I was just always looking for, a male role model figure. And and Mike and I became, very close friends. And he got to be that for me. And I, that's the, one of the things when he passed, one of the thoughts I had was, wow, how lucky am I that I got 30 years with this amazing man. And with his help and guidance and love, I turned into somebody that he was very proud of, because I definitely wasn't. I wasn't when I was 20. I was not the person you were proud of. I was like, you stay over there and keep your mouth shut and try not to say anything or do anything stupid.
You've been listening to a conversation with J.J. Blair discussing Mike Finnegan. Mike Finnegan's new self-titled LP is out now via the 40 Below label. You can find out more about that label and that recording at 40belowrecords.com. You can learn more about producer, mixer, and engineer J.J. Blair at jjblairrecordings.com. Learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening, and as always, we like to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torrin Anderson. See you next time.